welcome to Journey into Excellence, Episode 8. My name is Vernon Vohr, and I'll be your host for the next 90 minutes. Journey into Excellence is an ongoing monthly series where experts in their field will focus on how the evidence-based promotion of life, liberty, and happiness pursuit requires clear thinking and civility in our family, education, and leadership management systems. Each of our panelists brings something unique to the discussion, which they will share. Our panelists include Jack Malcolm. He's not with us today, but Jack is the president of Falcon Performance. Dr. Martin Haysacker, Ph.D. Marty is a professor of psychology at the University of Florida. Dr. Brian P. Higley, Ph.D. Dr. Higley is president and CEO of the Building Blocks to Excellence, which is a limited liability company, a company that focuses on promoting team excellence, personal effectiveness, and work-life satisfactions in individuals, teams, and organizations. And Mal Hyman, an associate professor of sociology at Corker University in Hartsville, South Carolina. In this episode, we will be continuing our comparison of the two different models of achieving a goal, the civility wheel versus the abuse wheel. Do you wish to start us off, Brian?
I sure do. So I thought what I would do is do just a quick review of the six different spokes that we have been talking about over the course of the last three episodes, and then we get into the final two spokes, which will complete the eight-spoke sort of overview. So the last couple of podcasts, last three actually, we talked about the difference between the power control wheel and the equality wheel and how to live and learn and lead from the equality wheel and how to differentiate ourselves from people who do so from the power control or the abuse wheel. We also talk about the equality wheel, the civility wheel. So power and control techniques tend to be centered on coercion and threats, intimidation, emotional abuse, isolation, using the less powerful, and using privilege. And then today we're going to get into the power and control techniques that are centered in minimization, denial, blame, and distortion, and economic abuse. So that completes all eight spokes of that nasty wheel. And then the equality wheel, sort of the opposite of the way power and control wheel techniques tend to go. We talked about dealing with people in terms of negotiation and fairness, using non-threatening behavior, using respect, using trust and support, being responsible leaders, and then also sharing responsibility. And today what we'll get into is the final two spokes of that, which is the opposite of economic abuse, which is economic partnership, and the opposite of minimization, denial, blame, and distortion is honesty and accountability. So with that, I thought I'd toss it on over to Marty to talk a little bit about these concepts in the family, and then we'll just kind of bounce off his ideas, if that's okay with you, Marty.
Sure, that sounds great. So the first spokes that I want to contrast with each other are the spokes of economic partnership versus economic abuse. And all of these come from Pence and Paymar's Duluth model, so just want to give credit where credit is due.
Yeah.
But I'm going to focus on it in the family. So economic partnership, and you could think about, for example, spouses or relationship partners, the civility wheel says make money decisions together and collaboratively. Make sure that both partners benefit from financial arrangements, which Seven Habits of Highly Effective People frames as the principle of think win-win. In contrast to that is the abuse wheel, or what Pence and Paymar call the power and control wheel, same thing, and it's using economic abuse to gain advantage over another, and it includes things like preventing your partner from getting or keeping a job. And I can tell you it also broadens out to your children. So preventing prevent your children from getting or keeping a job as a method of control. Making your partner or your children ask for money. Now there's an interesting one here, element called giving an allowance, and I think that means giving an allowance to one's romantic partner who is an equal, whereas the allowance model sounds like one person that should have control over the other. Stealing the money of your partner or of your children is an example of economic abuse, and not letting your partner know about family income that you have, hiding income, or not allowing your person to have your partner to have access to that family income. Those are all examples of the abuse wheel or the power and control wheel. So in families, these kind of money issues are very often hot-button issues. Families often struggle to make ends meet. We've seen an erosion, and I know that Mal will talk about this. We've seen an erosion of the financial resources of the middle class, and actually literally seen an erosion of the middle class. People are migrating to and what does that do? That puts financial pressure on families. We also know that things like college education are increasing in price, and so that also stretches families thin who are trying to either have the partners attend college or save for their children's college. And so what happens when you have a stress in the system is that you have a choice. You have a choice of behaving with civility or behaving with abuse or power and control. And so even though situations can be financially very, very tight in a family, the families that succeed and thrive are the ones that nonetheless share the have an economic partnership. And even with one's younger children, you can affect an appropriate level of partnership with your children about what financial resources they will have, help them work with them to come to, for example, an allowance figure that you both are comfortable with, or if you are a family where you give payment, quote unquote, for when children do particular things, that you do that in a way that is a partner with the child rather than sort of just a top down thing. On the abuse side, on the abuse side, it is pretty common for families to want to weigh in and tell teenage children, for example, that they shouldn't work or what jobs they should do or shouldn't do. And there is sometimes a legitimate parental concern there. But when it shifts over to doing it so that the parents can simply exert sort of more muscular dominance over teenage children, that may be something that families need to rethink. The other challenging issue is when one member of a romantic partnership is a stay-at-home person and usually a stay-at-home parent and doesn't work outside the home and the other person does. Those are situations that can be ripe for this economic abuse. The notion being the person who makes the outside-the-home salary is saying, well, I make the money so I get to make all the decisions. Well, you know, there's an inherent inequity there because the truth is both of them are exerting labor in service of the family's benefit, and it would be hard to imagine anything more important in life than effectively parenting the children, which facilitates work outside the home. The other challenging part, and this is much more common with 2019 families, is that both members of the partnership work outside the home, and one of them simply may be compensated a lot more than the other one. Sometimes flexibility of parenting comes at the price of salary and wage. And there it's a case where we want to be so careful that the person who brings in more money doesn't use that in a leveraging way. So those are some initial thoughts about the civility wheel and the abuse wheel with regard to economics of a family.
And one of the things I might piggyback on, Marty, about that is, and you had alluded to it, you know, we talked about one of the missions of this podcast is to not only talk about these things from sort of theoretical perspectives, but also to add some practical things that might be able to be helpful. And one of the things that occurred to me was sitting down with people who might not be earning as much but might be doing as much, if not more, labor. and right. talking about how we share what it is that we earn based on, I'm thinking now about equity theory, which is a pretty common theory that they use in business, which is you want to make sure that everybody in the group, and in this case, I'm thinking about in terms of the family, feels like that they're getting out what it is that they're putting in. And I think a lot of times it gets overlooked that people who might be doing things that aren't necessarily paid by a boss, but still is labor, that they feel as though they are being respected enough to be able to share what's going on in the entire system in terms of money, even though they might not be earning as much. So one of the things that I often recommend is sitting down and really thinking about, well, what are all the things that people do, for instance, if they're stay-at-home parents, and making a list of all the labor that happens there, and having a discussion centered around, I think, this idea of equity theory and recognizing that, hey, you might not be getting the kind of paycheck that I do, but look at this list of 10, 20, and 30 things that you do. That is labor, and that does deserve to have some kind of output, and I'd be happy to be somebody who shares what I make outside of the home in order so that you feel like that you're getting an equitable payment for what you do inside of the home.
Yep, that makes sense to me. I wanted to throw in another angle. You kind of inspired the thought of mine, Brian, which is the evidence indicates that in heterosexual marriages that break up, there is typically a more severe adverse financial impact on the woman in those heterosexual breakups than the man. And so what one of the things that leads me to ask people to consider is that in heterosexual enduring relationships, marriages, partnerships, that the couple consider that the woman has independent financial accounts, maybe independent investments, because of this pattern where divorce typically financially harms the woman more than the man. It's not true in every case, but in many cases, that this kind of arrangement, if it's something that the couple is comfortable with, actually creates a couple of things. It creates an insulation for the woman against that kind of problem in the event that there is a breakup. It also signals that she is a financially independent person who has resources that she can bring to bear or decide not to bring to bear on various family financial concerns and issues, which is usually a role that more typically is occupied in traditional marriages by the man. So it might be something that heterosexual couples want to consider as they're thinking about how to arrange or improve the economic relationship that they have in their families.
You know, and you're sort of stoking up a couple of other things that I think might make some sense. I'll offer it up, sort of broadening out from the sort of stereotypical heterosexual situation to maybe just include all situations is one of the things that I think would be good for people to consider is, let's say one person has, I'm just going to make up a number, they have $20,000 in the bank and another person has $0 in the bank. Could be really good to make sure that both people at some point feel like they have an equitable cushion. So one suggestion would be, certainly there are other ways to do it, but if I have $20,000 in the bank and you have zero, why don't we make sure that we both have $10,000 in our bank account?
Yeah, and the expenditure side also, I think one of the things this wheel doesn't talk about in this short telegraphed model, but which is, I still love it, is the expenditure side. So there needs to also be exactly the same kind of economic partnership on expenditure. So I know I have certainly known of couples where one member of the couple will spend significant amounts of money unilaterally to the upset and chagrin of the other person. And I've seen it happen. I've seen male transgressors on that as well as female transgressors on that. So I don't think it's particular to one gender, but that is another example of failing to exhibit shared responsibility, economic partnership in a family. So it seems like a reasonable rule of thumb would be anything but common repeated expenditures or relatively small expenditures probably should activate a partnership conversation in families among the responsible or relevant parties.
Mm. Yeah.
Marty.
Just kind of
briefly mention.
Go ahead. Yeah. No, please.
That
I was
family,
wondering if you might. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was wondering if you might respond to or elaborate. I don't know what the best way to phrase this, but as I listen to the civility wheel versus the abuse wheel, one thing that comes up in this conversation and along the way is that no matter which approach you take, you sacrifice and gain, so to speak. I don't know if those are the best words. You know, there's a cost to each one and a benefit or reward to each one. And could you elaborate on that a little bit? Because I think it's real easy in terms of the civility wheel to say, or in the abuse wheel to see, you know, what the reward is like, you know, you got power or whatever. But this is it's a subtlety that's interesting to me, and I'd like you to comment on it more if you would.
Vern, I'm happy to, and I love that question. So what I tell my students in my class when I discuss this is, and I'm looking at a group of people where upward of 30% of the people sitting in front of me are in a family that's engaging in some kind of abuse, whether it's just go through the wheel. It's not a trivial problem. Even among college students, because they come from families, you know, like all families that can be plagued by this. So what I say to my students is, why are members of families abusive? And, you know, people struggle with the answer, and I always say, because it works. In the short term, the person who engages in more abuse, in more coercion, more intimidation, more economic abuse, more privilege, more all of these elements, in the short term, this person is the most likely person to win the bet, the argument, the financial situation. But in the long term, the cost is relationships, and the cost is the mental health of the abuser and of those the abuser abuses. So the short-term gain is, you know, you win for the moment, and the long-term cost is that you lose relationships and lose yourself. In contrast, with the equality wheel, it's not at all guaranteed that you're going to win the day. And in fact, the odds are that you're going to come to a solution that is only partly satisfying compared to being able to intimidate and abuse and coerce and threaten and so on. But in the long run, it strengthens relationships and it improves your mental health. So go ahead.
Go ahead, Marty. I thought you were done. I apologize.
I'm done.
Another way to think about this, an acronym I've brought up over the course of the last couple of podcasts, I think every podcast maybe, is H2O, Health to Ourselves and Others. And I think that's a nice way to summarize what Marty said. And then another lens that I like to look through this with is, are we living the quote-unquote American dream? And it doesn't have to be limited to America. I just call it the American dream because I use language like life, liberty, and happiness pursuit. Certainly Americans aren't the only people who I think are pursuing that or deserve that. So one of the things in terms of H2O, Help to Ourselves and Others, if you're using the equality wheel in this regard, there's research that indicates that both your lives can be longer because you have less stress. And one of the top things that people stress about is money, right? And one of the, yes, isn't that nice? And so, one of the things that's pretty well known and one of the things that I cover in a lot of stress management classes is that stress is a correlate to almost all of the top reasons why we die. So you can actually elongate your life by not stressing over this money and fighting over this money, by sharing the money, so you have longer life. Liberty, I think this goes without saying. The more that we have sharing our money, the more it is that we feel at liberty to do more things. And I think closely connected is pursuit of happiness. The more that we're sharing money, the more we can pursue the things that we want to do, whether it be travel or a car that we like or clothes or whatever, we can both pursue happiness. So the argument I make comes from this H2O model, Help to Ourselves and Others. And I think there's a lot of evidence that if we do economic partnership, we'll have more life, liberty, and happiness pursuit than we do if we do economic abuse.
And I think it's fair to say if we change the level of analysis. Go ahead, Marty.
No, it's Mal. Go ahead, Mal.
Yeah,
I think it's fair to say if we change the level of analysis, what's been said can also apply. Takes a village to raise a child, but the village is now in a global economy, as is the family, being buffeted by more pressures than ever before in human history. And globalization has caused great wealth, but also great inequality. Automation has hollowed the middle class here, but in all developed countries. And the economic partnership has frayed quite a bit in the United States. Labor unions are weak. Corporate money has gone into Democrats as well as Republicans. Mm-hmm. And some of this can be seen with a minimum wage that traps people in poverty. About 85% of those who are in poverty are working, and the minimum wage hasn't gone up in about 10 years. So the notion of an economic partnership has broken down. We've seen it break down with about 50 million people having food insecurity and about 65 million of our fellow citizens not having access to decent health care. So that type of economic abuse is very rough on families, and we see high percentage of the public figuring it doesn't make any difference, not voting in any elections, a very divided public. And as in most places, most developed countries, some of the anger plays itself out against immigrants and other ethnic groups, as well as an analysis or clear thinking of the nature of the cause of the problems, being to a significant extent a rapidly moving global economy where there might not be any one group that's actually controlling it anymore. And that that inequality plays itself out at the national level through power politics, where the wealthiest 1% is putting in conservatively 95% of the money in elections and blinding a lot of Congress to the interests of working families and middle-class families and their concerns and needs. To look at this from a little different perspective, we talked about cooperatives in other segments. And cooperatives are an economic partnership or social enterprise where there is this grassroots democracy, and it's shown itself to be efficient, as well as creating less stress for people because they're actively part of determining their own destiny. Not taught much, kind of marginalized within the economic, political, and sociological literature, but big conferences all over Europe, Latin America, Asia, and Africa for cooperatives, which is a different version of economic partnerships. One other strategy that's pretty interesting that I've been reading about but don't claim to be an expert on is something called participatory budgeting, where in socialist countries and non-socialist countries in Latin America, a community will be told, you have a certain amount of money, you get to budget what happens with the money. It's your decision, decide it democratically. Done in Brazil, done in Venezuela, with pretty solid results. It's called participatory budgeting, and a number of PhDs are now being written on that. Again, it comes back to different versions of economic partnerships.
Mm-hmm. You know, Mal, that makes me want to piggyback on some education stuff. One of the things that I've been talking with all of you all about over the years is my sort of tendency to create, or at least work to try to create, democracies in the classroom. And one of the things that's been interesting to me across the years is how often folks in a, I sometimes put quotation marks around this, but in a democracy, quote unquote, how often that a lot of the gatekeepers in our education system seem to not trust democracy. they seem to only trust the idea of having a leader who in a more authoritarian way rather than an authoritative way, I would say, kind of tells people what it is they're going to do and how long they're going to do it and how many points they're going to get for it. And I join people like Carl Rogers, a psychologist who's also interested in democracy in the classroom, and another great psychologist, at least from my perspective, John Dewey, who basically said the same thing. I think this is more of a Dewey quote, but I think Rogers would basically sign off on this, that if you don't do democracy in classrooms, then people won't know how to do democracy out in the world. So, Mal, as you were talking about all the different things that have to do with shared economic partnership, it made me think about all the literature on democracies in classrooms and all of the different indicators, at least from my perspective, that many people in this quote-unquote democracy seem to really doubt democracy and really feel like that people in education won't get as much out of a democracy as they will out of a top-down approach, which runs counter to a lot of the literature, interestingly, literature that says that democratic classrooms and more top-down traditional classrooms perform relatively similarly in terms of the content. I get a lot of people supposing that democratic classrooms will naturally not get as much content as if someone like us are sort of jamming it down people's throats, so to speak. But what we found is that the data don't play that out. But another thing that plays out that's really interesting is that even though democratic classrooms seem to get across the same amount of content, in some cases maybe even more, that they help with life, liberty, and happiness pursuit much more. So we see in more democratic classrooms of people having better self-concepts, people having better self-esteem, people being able to communicate better. So it's been really interesting to me to watch as I've traveled around the nation and consulted and taught at different educational institutions that people seem to have a presupposition that runs counter to the data that top-down traditional authority-centered classrooms will be better for people than democratic classrooms, when the data actually show us that the opposite is true. And I think it sets us up to not be educated well enough to be able to do some of this partnership stuff, Mal, that you were speaking about.
Brian.
I agree with you. Our notion of democracy. Marty, do you want to jump in on this one?
Nope, that was Vern.
Oh, I'm sorry. What
Go
I would
ahead, Mal.
Suggest is our notion of democracy is, as Brian alluded to, very limited, that you follow the laws, you pay your taxes, and you vote. And we've done a poor job of teaching active citizenship or community building, or having people have the strength to speak truth to power with love so we can create a more civil and practical society amidst all the economic storms. We failed on that, and I think looking at the dialogue that's going on between Republicans and Democrats and the media that's happened just this past week over the impeachment hearings is evidence of societal breakdown, that we've not done an adequate job. And what Brian's suggesting is a new paradigm for learning democracy, that it has to be practiced experiential learning. And I think the same thing applies in the workplace. You become a stronger Democrat, a stronger citizen, if you're actively part of the decision-making in the workplace.
Yeah, and I can't tell you how often now when I'm sitting with gatekeepers across the nation in our colleges and universities, when I explain that very thing and even show the data to support it, how much I think about it as irrational cynicism in the face of both philosophical and scientific data that people seem to have about those very ideas in education. It just seems like so many people in our culture really don't think democracy is the best way to go, that we cannot trust democracy. And I think Dewey and Rogers and others made this really, really clear, both in terms of their philosophy and their science, is that you can call our culture what you want, democracy, whatever. But if you don't have actual experiences, now you mentioned experience or learning, if you don't have actual experiences of democracy working out, then I think you're going to be cynical about democracy, and we're not going to have, we're functionally not going to have a democracy. And I really think that was Dewey's point when he basically said, if you don't do democracy in your classrooms, you cannot have it in your culture.
So, so I wanted to shift. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I wanted to shift to a slightly different issue, which I think is very much related to economic abuse versus partnership. And I wanted to start with a quote that I have loved for many years from Kurt Vonnegut, who said, the two real political parties in America are the winners and the losers. The people don't acknowledge this. They claim membership in two imaginary parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, instead. And the reason I bring that up is because I think the fault line that we currently see both in the Democratic Party with, for example, Bernie Sanders, who is an avowed non-Democrat, an independent, for months and months and months leading the in opinion polls and still closely in the hunt even after his heart attack, and Donald Trump, who clearly always has represented positions that at best oscillate somewhere around and not always around the central points of traditional Republicanism, and yet garners a large number of voters who were Democrats. I think those two things together signal that members of both parties are understanding this Kurt Vonnegut quote issue clearly, that what we really have going on is a situation where financial elites are overrepresented in the political process compared to what Americans overall would like there to be. And so in these candidates, they are putting extra strength and faith and emphasis as a way to try to address this this economic disempowerment.
I want to piggyback on that really quickly because it brings to mind one of my favorite George Washington quotes. It goes like this: however, political parties you're referring to may now and then answer popular ends, they are likely in the course of time and things to become potent engines by which cunning, ambitious, and unprincipled men will be enabled to subvert the power of the people and to usurp for themselves the reign of government, destroying afterwards the very engines which have lifted them to unjust dominion.
There was a sociologist that looked at the German Socialist Party and found that it had drifted into the hands of elites, and saw that with other organizations and political parties, and called it the iron law of oligarchy. And I think it may well be a tendency, even with progressive parties, and I know Washington feared the baneful influence of political party. It's not clear how you can run a democracy without political parties. They can be run different ways.
Or they could be different parties. We may end up with the Whigs. These two parties may become the Whigs and the Tories of our generation.
Could well be. I agree with your analysis that the support for Sanders and for Trump essentially was within both parties and some of the independents a sense for much greater change, that the traditional parties had failed, and people wanted
Around financial,
either more progressive with Sanders, or that would shake up the Republican Party. It's a dissident vote that's quite strong at this point. We just don't lend ourselves to proportional representation in third parties in our system. Whereas if this was anywhere else, we'd have a strong series of third, fourth, and fifth parties already.
And your argument is that may make the transition from these two parties much slower than it otherwise might be?
Exactly.
I'm also reminded of some of the social psych literature on how to get people We're talking economic partnership, but I guess we'll just talk about partnership in general. How to move people from wanting to partner to wanting to actually abuse and defeat and hold dominion over, to use a word from the Washington quote I just talked about. And Marty, you can talk about this as well, if not better than I can, I imagine. But here's the recipe for it. Create two groups and get them to believe that there is an important resource that is limited. And once you get two groups separated and focused on a resource that they believe to be limited, in this case, we could call it power, but we could also bring it back and talk about economics, which, of course, are related. That is the recipe, according to social psychologists, for people failing to partner and starting to try to dominate the other group. Marty, I don't know if there's anything you want to add to that.
That's well said.
Psychology.
Well said.
Okay.
It's the zero-sum game problem. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mel, you were going to say something also, and I'd love to hear that.
Well, I've long feared the iron law of oligarchy impacting all organizations, and it's an anti-democratic tendency. And I fear there's a lot of power to that observation, whether it's the Red Cross or the Catholic Church or the Democratic Party or the Socialist Party, and it certainly was true in the Communist Party, that certain people with a will to ambition and power will use the slogans and values of the organization, keep information from others, and essentially abuse them and have power drift into the hands of a few. And I think that may well be a counter-democratic tendency that's quite powerful and might come back to Jefferson's notion the price of liberty is eternal vigilance, that this may be a tendency in humanity. Now, I've always wondered if this would have been true prior to the agricultural revolution, but I'm outside of my field at this point. You know, you have to be looking more clearly at anthropology as to whether that's a general tendency for power to drift into the hands of a few.
I think that's a nice segue into our next spoke, and that is honesty and accountability. And I think people who are honest and accountable will try to actually embody what it is that they're trying to do. So if it's regardless of what the party is, honest and accountable people will try to, if they say, I'm a Republican, I'm a Democrat, I'm a socialist, I'm a communist, whatever, they'll try to embody those actual principles. Now, the opposite of that on the power control wheel is minimization, deny, blame, and then I add distortion. And I think, Mal, some of what you were talking about is the opposite of honesty and accountability, and that is people who will infiltrate these different groups, and either consciously or subconsciously, it's difficult for me to tell somebody's mind from the outside, but they'll say, okay, if I become a part of this party, and I think that this is a little bit of what Washington was talking about, and if I can fake acting like this party, I can get enough power and control over these people to eventually get what it is that I want out of them. So I think we've got some troubles, regardless of the party that you choose, with people who, instead of being honest and accountable and saying, I call myself X, and here are the top five things that are associated with being X, and I'm trying really hard to be those top five things, we have someone that says, ooh, there's an opportunity for me to gain dominion over this group if I can just minimize, deny, blame, and distort enough to get them to push me to the top of the ladder.
So Brian, at the risk of getting a little bit disjointed, were you going to talk a little bit about economic abuse and economic partnership with regard to the education community, or did we cover that sufficiently?
Yeah, I'm glad that you brought that up. So just a few things that I had that I think relate to what we're talking about. I did mention the irrational cynicism of partnership with students in order to create a democracy. So oftentimes the H2O-centered educational approach, as I think everybody here knows, is centered around getting together with students and collaborating on what it is that we want to do, and collaborating together on how it is that we want to change or to give people credit, whether it be points or grades or whatever, for what it is that they do. And I think that kind of a model is grounded in that the same theory I just talked about, equity theory. What I'm putting in is what I get out. And I think maybe the only way to try to promote equity theory in the classroom is through collaboration. But I think we're getting so much, or at least I'm getting so much cynicism from folks that say, no, you cannot trust the students to collaborate with you. They will be lazy. They will BS, they will lie, they will cheat, they will try to figure out the least amount of things that they can do in order to get the grade if you collaborate with them, when in actuality, both my experience and the data say that is true of the opposite, that if you don't collaborate with people and they don't feel like there's an equitable input and output, that they're more likely to do the very things that the people who don't seem to have a lot of trust in democracy fear. So that's one area, and I've already kind of talked a little bit about that. But in terms of shared governance of the classroom and then sharing the points, I think sharing in terms of how we're going to distribute points and grades, not just based on what I think is good, but based on what we think is good, I think that trains people to do the same thing when they get out, and points then become money. So I think the economics of the classroom is often points and grades, right? And I think if we learn to do collaboration and sharing in terms of points and grades, that might set people up to have had the experiential learning that Mal talked about, to be able to partner up in terms of money. The other thing, I think, Mal, you'll probably have a lot to say about this, I'm imagining, is a lot of what's happening in terms of the finances with affordability of higher education. Now you talk about healthcare, but as you know, another big thing in terms of shared economic partnership is how are we going to give everybody a fair shake in terms of higher education? And I really am wanting to defer to you, Mal, to talk a little bit more about that, because I think that has a lot to do, obviously, the consequences play out in education, but I think maybe some of the causes play out in politics. So, Mal, do you have anything you want to say about the rising costs of higher education and how that might decrease the probability that people get a fair shot?
Well, it sure comes up on the campaign trail all the time, and you hear it from students. I have for years, and I don't want to claim any expertise. I did start UCLA in 1968, where it was $300 a year. And I thought that would last forever because it was an investment in society. And if you could work hard enough to get there, that you would help society afterwards enough that it would pay for itself. And that certainly has not proven to be the case in the United States. But it leaves us at a competitive disadvantage, because in most of the developed world, public college is just about free. And we've made life a lot tougher for many people who don't have access to resources to go to school. And we've also weakened ourselves as a society because of that. You need more and more education in a global economy. So it's along with the lack of respect that we have for people working at minimum wage, or the lack of investments even in rebuilding our infrastructure, which could include schools and public housing to strengthen families. And, you know, if you were to put it up to a poll, most of the public thinks it's a good idea. But we come back again into what Marty was talking about with the power of corporations and financial institutions in both political parties, so those investments aren't made. And the great frustration with independents, Democrats, and Republicans with the status quo of the Republican and Democratic Party. People want change. You know, I think with Sanders, what we're hearing is public education for free and to eliminate all student debt. These are maximal positions. You could say it's political opportunism,
I think in his heart he actually believes it when I've talked to him. But there is a strategic method to this, or I guess a tactical method, in that if you go into Congress with a proposal, you want it to be a strong proposal because you know there's going to be compromise and you'll end up with a lot less of it. So as Sanders has told me, I don't want to compromise with myself. So I'll ask for what I think is right, and we'll end up with half of that if I get elected. So I think that undergirds some of the tactical positions taken by the candidates on it. And it's increasingly a problem. You know, I've had, as you guys probably have, literally dozens of students drop out because they can't afford to continue their education. They have to go back and raise money and support their families. So critical problem for the strength of families and communities in a global economy.
Well, you mentioned that, Marty, if we need to go back to the previous spoke again, feel free. I don't care about being disjointed, but yet
again.
I was going to put one little detail
on there. Mal's $300 at Berkeley in 68 is now $2,213, but the point is still the same.
Is it 2200 or 22,000?
The 2200. So $300 in 1968 is equal to $2,213.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I thought you were saying that that's what they charge at UCLA now, and I was incredulous.
No, I think they're charging.
That's what it's worth now. Yeah.
I think they're charging a little more than 2213.
Okay. Yeah.
Mal, did you
I was wondering if you were just misreading something. Yeah.
Somewhere around 20,000, but I've heard higher than that, and I've kind of lost track.
Yeah.
Yeah, much more burdens.
Yeah, exactly. So that $300.
So if it was the same sort of price as it was then with inflation, we'd be paying $2,200 a year. That's what you're saying, right,
correct,
Marty? Yeah.
Yep, that's
my
what
goodness.
Saying.
That's amazing. So we need
like
to bounce back
concept,
to different folks.
Go ahead, Mal.
I'm sorry. No, please, Mal. Go.
Well, I was just going to say it means you have some skin in the game. You have some responsibility, but it's certainly not burdensome.
Yeah, sure. I think that's the essence of this partnership idea, that the more, I think Marty talked about it in terms of family, if we partner up in the family, we have responsibilities, but they're not as heavy. And then we have, we all have outcomes. They might not be, we might not have quite as many people with billions and billions of dollars, but maybe they have hundreds of millions while other people have more money. So we share the burden and we share the outcomes. I think in education, the same thing. Maybe some of us who are doing better pay a little bit more. And I would hope that, you know, if we have that sort of partnership idea, there would be less, I don't know, less hostility about that from certain folks. The idea that, you know, I need extra millions and millions and millions of dollars. I don't know. To me, that seems like it could be leaning a little toward the hoarding kind of I don't want to call it a mental illness. I'll just call it a tendency, I guess. And then spreading it out to the entire culture. But I think part of the problem with partnership gets to the next spoke. And again, Marty, if we need to go back to another spoke, or Mal, you want to go to another spoke, that's completely fine with me. But the idea of minimization, deny, blame, and distortion seems to me to play a role in how we divide from each other rather than how we partner with each other. Mal, you mentioned immigrants, poor people, that sort of a thing. And getting back to our first round of talks, which was on logical fallacies and how they can lead us to be uncivil and how being more valid can lead us to more equality and civility, I've heard a lot of what some people call the genetic fallacy, which basically means that you judge somebody based on who they are at their core, how they look, whatever. And I feel like a lot of the discussion that might divide us is often based on the genetic fallacy. And poor people, working people, people of this color or that color. And I feel like one of the things that we could do is decrease the minimization, denial, blame, and distortion by decreasing those kinds of fallacies so that instead of thinking about us versus them, we instead start thinking more about partnership. So I just thought I'd throw that comment out and see if there's anything anybody wants to say about the family or the political system or the business world or the education world around that theme.
Yeah, let me start with the family. So all of these folks, but this one in particular is one that families, I think, can and do readily identify with, whether it's abuse or civility. So on the civility side, the number one thing in this spoke of honesty and accountability is accepting personal responsibility. And you often mention Carl Rogers. This was one of the core tenets of Carl Rogers' approach to psychotherapy and to self-improvement, that you start by taking personal responsibility for what you've done and who you are. And then the second component of this spoke is, if you have engaged in violent behavior or abusive behavior in the past, that you own that, you acknowledge it, you don't pretend it doesn't happen. And the reason that becomes so critical is because this notion of denial is actually a hallmark feature of its opposite, a hallmark feature of the abuse cycle, the abuse wheel. Mm. Then the third component is admitting you are wrong. When you are wrong, admitting clearly that you have made a mistake or been inaccurate or been untruthful or been inappropriate or hurtful or mean-spirited or whatever it is. And that's a critical component for families. And then finally, communicate openly and truthfully. So when you think about the family context, each member of the family makes moment-to-moment decisions about whether he or she will be personally responsible for his or her behavior. If this person has been violent, that person can make the choice to pretend it didn't happen or to acknowledge that it did. When we are wrong, each of us has that moment when we decide we're going to own it or we're going to hide it. And this happens in families all the time. This happens in my family. And then finally, communicating openly and truthfully, but not in a threatening way, not in an abusive way, not in a menacing way. So those are the characteristics that in day-to-day family life, whether it's while watching a sports event on TV or whether it's over the dining room table or whether it's people working in the backyard raking up leaves or whether it's trying to understand what happened in the report card that doesn't look like it's so good. These are all opportunities when we can engage in honesty and accountability or not. And then the or not side, in families, people who have been abusive in the family, whether that's verbal abuse or financial abuse or manipulation of children or isolating or intimidation or breaking things. I mean, abuse in families occurs in lots and lots of different ways, but we know when it's happening. So the contrasting thing is that instead of owning the abuse you have engaged in, that you make light of it. You say it wasn't that big a deal, or you gaslight and say it didn't happen. Or when somebody expresses concerns about your behavior that's hurtful, that you blow it off. Don't take it seriously. I think one of the dangers of the phrase snowflake, which I think our colleagues on the political right have often embraced, particularly our talk show radio colleagues, snowflake can be so easily misused to minimize the harm that someone has done to another person. And in our families, we can do that. Oh, toughen up. You got to be tough. Big boys don't cry. Get over it. Mm-hmm. I didn't mean it. I was teasing. Kids take a joke. All of those are examples of not taking concerns about abuse seriously from a family member. So it's much wiser to err on the side of leaning in, as Brian Higley would say, of embracing the feedback, even if you're not sure you believe it. But when it's around these issues of the impact that you've had on me has been a hurtful impact, leaning into that feedback and listening carefully and as much as you can, non-defensively embracing it, those are all ways to step away from denying and blaming and minimizing. Another thing we can do is this sort of gaslighting thing where you engage in abusive behavior and then you pretend you didn't. One of the few good things about when somebody in a family punches a hole in a wall or breaks something or does another one of these sort of irrefutable physical gestures is you can't engage in denial. That wall has a hole in it. That lamp is broken. That beer glass got busted, and it's all over the floor. That TV has had a shoe thrown in it, and it's broken now. Those are
the sheetrock was weak. The glass was poor glass.
right.
That sneaker just.
I just tapped it. I didn't punch it. I tapped it.
Exactly.
You shouldn't have put
hilarious.
It so precariously on the edge of the table. I'm sorry, Marty. I had to throw that in.
That's good.
It's funny. I would love to be able to say I've never heard or said anything like that, but both would be false.
No one's perfect here. I think that's important.
Two other things have to do with shifting responsibility. So on the equality wheel, on the civility and equality wheel, you own it. And on the power and control or abuse wheel, you shift responsibility for your abusive behavior onto the other person. Well, she made me do it. I was disrespected by that comment. Therefore, it's okay that I did this. All those blamey things. And in fact, it's funny. One of the things that happens that I smile about a lot is that people who are not psychologists psychologize about abuse. And so I'll be in conversations where even psych majors that I have that I work with in the lab will say, well, you know, this bad thing happened, but he just lost control, and so it wasn't his fault. And I say, wait a minute. So he hit her, but has he hit a police officer? Has he hit one of the Gator football players? Has he hit his boss?
Has he control if he's not hitting a bunch of big football players on campus, right?
Yeah, at the bars, does he hit those bouncers with the leather jackets on? And the answer to all those is no. I say, well, then he has control.
Yes.
Yeah.
Want to sort of piggyback, Marty, really quickly on honesty and accountability in the education system. And I think a lot of this relates to the economics, I'll call it, of the classroom, which often is points and grades. And I think that students oftentimes have a real dilemma in classroom. And I think that this relates a little bit to economic partnership as well, because I don't think this would be as intense if fewer people had to worry about getting something to eat, getting a job, having a home, that sort of thing. But oftentimes I feel like students are really put in this dilemma of oftentimes if they are honest about what's going on in the classroom, they recognize, well, I'm going to lose points. And if I lose points and I get low grades, I think in their minds, this may or may not be true. You know, it's difficult really to test this empirically, but I think so often in people's minds, they think, well, if I get a B or I get a C, a D, F, or whatever, I won't get a job. And then if I don't get a job, I won't be able to live. So I think there's a lot of pressure. Even though it's hard to empirically test, you know, there are college dropouts who become billionaires. We know that, right?
Net, it's not hard to test. The truth is that over a lifetime, a person who completes a college degree on average earns, I think the number is $1 million more than his or her counterpart that doesn't.
So we can know in general, but we can't know about that specific student, right? That student could end up dropping out of Harvard and creating Facebook. I mean,
be Bill Gates, right? Exactly.
Yes. But I think it's very real to the student, and I really I understand the dilemma, because oftentimes in my class I'm trying to promote honesty. Did you do this on time? Okay, you didn't. Well, here's the late work policy, and it's not going to look good, you know. And then accountability, another thing that is often, I think, promoted oftentimes by the gatekeepers. I've heard so many gatekeepers across the nation say educators are accountable for the learning of their students. And so I think they mean well, but I think oftentimes what they don't recognize that folks like Carl Rogers and others did recognize is that if you take accountability for your mentee, your client, your business partner, whatever, you're training them very often not to take accountability for themselves. So those are a couple of things in education that I think are real challenges. How do we reinforce honesty, and how do we reinforce personal accountability in education for one's own learning so that they're set up to take personal accountability for one's own life over the long haul?
Yeah.
Now, some of the things that
start at an early age.
Yeah.
A lot of families aren't going to do it, and we've got to model it, whether it's kind of Montessori model or something like that, but to teach kids to have the courage of an open mind and the courage of their convictions so they can be responsible, but also that this is their community, and they have to find a way to treat each other as they want to be treated, and it is going to have to start early. A lot of those habits, as you guys know, are pretty well set by the time we get them as freshmen. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure we have put in place the methods that will create courage of an open mind, courage of conviction, and courage to listen and hear the other so you can see yourself in others. I think those are possible, but it is harder when we get them at the college level, particularly my usual extrapolation to honesty and accountability. I don't think it's modeled very well at the national level when we look at government, whether it's why we really got into Iraq, what's going on with Iraq now, what really happened with 9/11, why don't we release the files on who killed Martin Luther King? I mean, there's a lot of reasons that people distrust government, that the system of accountability and checks and balances has not served us as well as it looked on paper in the Constitution. So people aren't getting that modeled from the national government. I think President Trump is probably the worst example. He's a little more like the poster child for the seven deadly sins than somebody you'd like to have your child emulate.
Yeah, and as somebody who really does buy into Washington's notion of watching out for parties, I always want to stick up for the other party when someone mentions another party, not because I'm part of that party, but because I do want to be fair. But I think from the other side, people look at people like Bill Clinton and other folks and say, well, the other party's got issues in that as well. Not that I want to knock down either party. I think both parties oftentimes are guilty, but I want to make sure that the listeners know and that you all know that I see it in both parties and in all sort of aspects of politics myself.
Sure. And, you know, shifting gears a little bit, I have an interesting example of what I think is clear thinking and civility from a perhaps unexpected source. Met a fellow who's a lieutenant colonel, headed the Defense Department efforts on counterterrorism. Had been in Afghanistan for a number of years. Tried the civil action programs, building schools and hospitals and roads and bridges, and saw that it wasn't working all that well, and realized that the community has to be brought in on the decision-making process. So upon retirement, this lieutenant colonel set up an NGO, and he's putting up solar arrays in rural Afghan valleys and teaching the people to work together, to maintain it together, and to own it as theirs. And it's the evolution of counterterrorism. And I think a tribute to his effort to be open-minded and the courage of his conviction to try to think clearly as to how do you win over these people. And he's coming upon many things that we've been talking about today in terms of collaboration, respect, and civility.
You know, you make me think now of writing that I remember from, again, I guess this is the Carl Rogers episode. I'm going back to him. But in his his most famous book, On Becoming a Person, there's a chapter in there where he discusses, I think, being honest and accountable. And at the time, you know, our big rival when he was writing, I think it was published somewhere 50, 60, something like that, was Russia. You know, we had the Cold War going on. And he has a lot of, Soviet Union, thank you, that's right. And he asked a lot of accountability and honesty questions, like what if we could just say, instead of saying America all good, Soviet Union all bad, what if we could just essentially be accountable and say, well, here are some of the things that, as the United States, that we did poorly. I forget exactly what he said, but, you know, he could have referenced what we did to Native Americans, what we've done to Black Americans, what we did to Africans before they were even Americans, forcing them to become Americans. And I think what he was basically saying, wouldn't it be nice if, as a nation, we could say, look, here's all the bad stuff we did. Kind of getting back to what you were talking about, Marty, is about what to do if you've done bad things. Don't hide it. Just say these are a list of bad things. That it might be more likely that the Soviet Union would say, okay, and here are all of our bad things. And that the center of that was this thought that is grounded, I think, in social psych as well, that if we could just be honest and accountable about what we're doing both poorly and what we're really proud of, and they could do the same, then we could probably move past this Cold War. And I think so much of that is true in terms of our family systems, our education systems, our business systems, and our political systems. It feels like a lot of people, and certainly I'm not perfect, like you said, Marty, I've been had my own struggles with this. This is not easy work. I think Rogers used to say it's simple, but it's not easy. What if we could just say, okay, here are the things that I'm really not proud of, and here are the things I'm really proud of. What are you not proud of, and what are you not really proud of, and how do we partner together and move forward with people with differing views and different ideas, but both with weaknesses and strengths?
Mm-hmm. You know,
I like that a lot.
Go ahead, Marty. Yeah, I like it. I was gonna tack back to the family because there's an interesting process I've noticed in myself and in other people. So, when a member of a family has engaged in minimization, denial, blame, distortion, as you added, I think correctly so, and then changes. What I've noticed, both in myself and in other people, is this person who has shifted away from this and starting to own it, often thinks, you know, it's going to be sort of like the welcome of the prodigal son from the Bible, that the recognition that you've shifted away from abuse is going to be met with joy and celebration.
Congratulations in a celebratory party.
Exactly. And of course, what more likely happens is the poor people in your family who have been the brunt of this abuse, denial, blame, distortion, still have some unresolved pain and some unresolved anger a lot of times. And so what I do want to say to people and families where you have been abusive in whatever way and you've decided to make the change, fantastic. We're very proud of you. And expect that it's not over yet. Expect that you're going to have to spend some time attending to the consequences of your prior abusive behavior. And just know going in that is going to be a necessary aspect of your shifting from abuse to civility.
And I think
Marty, are you saying that abuses
go ahead now.
Lead to messes
oh, I'm sorry,
that
yeah.
are going to have to be cleaned up?
That's a beautiful way to say it, Vern. Abuse leads to messes that have to be cleaned up. And this is something that the 12-step program of AA anticipates, expects, this whole issue of a fearless and searching moral inventory in the 12-step program and then making amends. All of that
is, I think,
a recognition that the declaration that you're past it doesn't mean you don't have to make up for the mess that you've made, just as you said, Vernon.
And I would add that part of accountability, I think a lot of people think that just saying I take accountability means you took accountability. But to me, part of accountability is saying I will clean up the mess even if it takes the rest of my life. So I know what it means to have made a mess. And part of taking accountability is if this is a lifelong cleaning job, then I commit to a lifelong cleaning job.
Right. And without
Go ahead.
Without any expectation that the relationships that you've been abusive in are necessarily going to survive this. You do it because it's the right thing to do, not because you anticipate there's going to be a payoff for you. There may be no payoff for you other than you're atoning for what you have done that's been abusive.
And I would say, I know Mal has something to say, but I'll take it back real quick and then toss it over to Mal. To go to the power control wheel, one of the spokes we talked about earlier in a previous podcast was using emotional abuse. And I would say if you're doing this in order to manipulate someone to stay with you, that's not accountability. I would argue that's
that ain't the
using
reason.
Emotional abuse. Mal, did you have something else to add?
Yeah, saw some of this
as a congressional candidate coming into black churches, and then NAACP meetings. And they were interested in the fact that I taught 44 years and I taught in a state prison. What really started to open people up is exactly what you said, more honest accountability about power in America, that that our constitutional compromise was our original sin, and it had been a plantation mentality, and there are still elements of an economic plantation mentality, and people were listening to me on that. I was getting some of the older folks taking a good look at me when I said it like that, and it was, you know, I had not gone there before, and I, you know, in class can say those things, but usually it's not within the first 5 minutes. And yet that's kind of the opening ante to show that you're serious about this and that your ideas and my ideas are kind of parallel Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. And people will listen to me once they kind of get a sense of, is this guy trustworthy? Has he seen how we got into this problem in the first place? And I think it is part of the healing process. The other thing I'll note is black community doesn't seem to care that much that I've lost a couple times. They just want a fighter that's given them common sense. So they see it as a long, slow fight, a struggle, if you will. And I had not expected some of that, but in the midst of the fray, you know, that's where I'm at today with just the general observations that people want to struggle on these things, but the distrust goes very, very deep. And it takes a while to earn people's trust that you are somebody worthy of the honor of representing them.
So Mal, I think that as you were talking now, go ahead, Marty, go ahead.
For our listeners who may not know the background, Mal, talk about, put a little flesh on the bones of this issue about you running for office so that listeners can understand where you're coming from.
I'd been in politics all my life, really canvassing for Robert Kennedy, and had run a congressional campaign for a fellow who was part of the Pentagon Papers in 1984. He was my mentor in grad school, and you know, in teaching, I thought maybe there'll be a season where I actually take my hand at running. And 2016, it looked like there was enough health and the family was doing okay, so I threw my hat in the ring and I ran for Congress, 7th congressional district, and lost. It was a big year for Donald Trump, and then I ran again in 2018 and lost by 400 votes in a primary, and I'm leaning toward running again in 2020 if health of family members is, is sustained. So I've seen what it's like, kind of participant, observer, experiential learning, and certainly been a humbling and an intriguing experience for me to see it up close. Certainly, the process is cleansing or corrosive early on, because you're going to need some resources and to speak to a range of communities, and has been a learning experience for me in terms of how to speak and communicate, and also to listen well to the issues that are salient for folks in a large community. So I could ramble a number of directions, but no regrets. And I think I became a better citizen by being part of the process.
You know, I want to talk a little bit about go ahead, Marty. Keep going.
I was just going to say, which state? You said congressional, but which congressional district of which state?
South Carolina. 7th congressional district, which is 8 counties. A winnable district, but tough for Democrats. It's 55% Republican, which puts it on the edge of flippable, so that it only happened in a year where, you know, it's a big surge for Democrats. And come to realize a lot of this isn't so much knowing the candidate at a congressional level. It's a referendum on the president. And if there's strong sentiment against the president, then the Democrat might be pushed in this time. So it is a winnable district. You have to raise a lot of money. A story that listeners might find interesting, when I met Nancy Pelosi and asked for opposition research, she quickly told me, after you raise $700,000 and show us a poll that indicates you can win, we'll be glad to help you. So that's where the establishment of the Democratic Party is. And being a professor, going into my 401k after about $200,000, that was it. So I kind of learned the process a little bit more clearly. But again, no regrets, and it is possible to figure out how to win without taking big money. And I quickly determined that, you know, you can try to take it, but you're losing your soul in the process. So I went for what Sanders did, small donations online, and found that it's quite possible, but difficult to do that. And you go, you raise money outside of your congressional district to make it possible. One more point I might add, if you do raise the $700,000, what the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee does is they send in people to help you with your messaging, which means you'll get additional support, but it won't be your message anymore.
Great point. And I think that gets to some of the major things that Mal and I had many conversations as he was going through this process over breakfast every once in a while and just hanging out in our offices. We were right across the hall from each other when I was at Coker. And one of the things we talked about, Mal, I don't know if you remember this, but it's something that I'll always remember, is doing things, the difficulty, but the I think the importance of doing things for intrinsically motivated reasons. So you talked about, you know, meeting with these people from the parties. And again, I stay out of parties, but I think both parties do it, is they basically say, well, there's these all these extrinsic things that you need to do in order for you to be embraced by the party. And so it can be really difficult, as you just spoke about, of having your own message and not losing yourself in the process of being extrinsically motivated, and instead doing things because you think that they're right, because you enjoy them, because they're aligned with your values. This relates to a scientific theory called self-determination theory, which I think is one of the major change theories that I think should be at the core of any authentic democracy, determining things for yourself. And so oftentimes I talk about the challenges with students and business people and politicians about how do you keep self-determination theory in mind? How do you keep your own goals, your own values, the things that you enjoy at the forefront of your life as you try to do some of these things that you want to do, whether it's, you know, get a job, become elected, start a family. And I think one of the things that needs to happen, I'll talk a little bit about education here, is instead of just talking about points, grades, diplomas, and then we move to money and jobs and cars and homes and corner offices and elected offices and all of these extrinsic things, to at least balance it with talking about, are you doing what you enjoy? Are you doing what you value? What are your goals? And I found so often when I discuss this with students, the first thing that I do, I guess this is a little practical hint for what people can do who want to do this. The first week that I work with anybody, whether it be a business person or one-on-one with an individual or with students, it starts with the process of identifying what people's roles are. So you as an individual, you as an educator, you as a politician, you as a radio talk show host, whatever's important to you. And then identifying the top three objectives that will help you play those roles out. So for individuals, they often talk about their personal health. For people who want to be good partners, they talk about their communication. For people who want to be good at their job, they talk about staying on top of the latest material in their field, whatever it is. And oftentimes when I encounter people doing it, they tell me that this is the first time that they've ever been asked to think about their roles and objectives, their values, their goals, what it is they enjoy. And I think that's just a real sad commentary on two things. One is our education and our mentorship system, And the second thing is it's a commentary on, or maybe it's not a commentary, I think it maybe it's an explanation for why so many people are so burned out, so depressed, so anxious, because the literature is pretty clear that the recipe for burnout is to overdo the extrinsic reinforcement, to fixate on getting that political position, getting that job, getting that A, and paying no attention or little to no attention to your own goals, your own values, and what it is that you enjoy. And I can't tell you how many people that I've worked with across the lifespan who, when we start asking them questions, are you doing what you enjoy? It's almost like they're waking up from a sometimes decades-long sleep, and they say, oh, yeah, I'm supposed to enjoy my life. So as you were talking, Mal, I thought of our discussions about, well, what are the extrinsic potential outcomes of these things? And then trying to balance that with, Mal, do you think that it's right? Do you think that it's good? And then go do it.
Oh, a great set of discussions. And I'm tempted to let you have the last word, but I have come upon something in the process that I wanted to share, and then I'll let you guys close the show. You know, I think the country was founded, you know, in the Declaration of Independence, people committed their lives, their fortune, and their sacred honor to form America. And I think that's the set of values that could move us toward clear thinking and civility.
Well said. Vern, were you going to add something or ask something?
Yeah, I was going to tell you, I think you've been reading my notebooks. What I wrote down several weeks ago, probably about a month ago, and one of the things I would say about your intrinsic values and stuff is there's this tremendous tendency being human, both you psychologists would know this, to live one's life in comparison to someone else's. We look out there in terms of what's defined as success or whatever. So very simply what I wrote down in my notebook was he wasn't what many would consider successful in life. He lived and did what was important to him. And, you know,
the word that comes
to
mind when I listened to that, Vern, is liberty. It just popped up in my mind when you said that quote triggered the word liberty in my mind, authentic liberty.
Yeah, and that was a note that I wrote down here that would be, for Marty, in terms of taking responsibility in life, I jotted down a note when he was bringing some stuff forward, is when one admits one's mistakes, one's sins, however you want to look at it, speak about it, or whatever. Once you realize that, in fact, you may not get the applause you expected for coming clean, there's something very freeing about being able to admit when I'm wrong or admit the mistakes I make, because there's a real freeing aspect about that in life, I would say, for someone that's willing to go through the pain, if you will, or the hardship of doing it, especially in the beginning. After a while, you start to recognize that you are Einstein had a very interesting way of saying it, is that that all our lives are a work of art. And when you don't have to be perfect and recognize that you make mistakes, that's where I've come to see life anyway. That's very freeing. So I wanted to share that. I threw it over to Marty, Brian, Mal to finish it out.
Before we go to Marty, I think I had my last say. Mal, I don't know if you felt like that was your last say, but before we do that, I do want to point out, I think that is, again, just some practical advice, which is what we're about here, is looking at it theoretically but also practically. I think that's just great practical advice, Vern, is that if you've got some things that you're really ashamed of or that you don't want to admit, work at practicing admitting it to people. Find a friend, your most loving friends, your most empathic friends. Start with them, and maybe start with the least embarrassing thing, and just practice being transparent, being authentic, being congruent about some of these things that you're hiding. And I think you'll find that if you pick the right person, you know, you can't go to somebody who's going to be harsh on you, but if you pick the right person, that it can be freeing. Marty, is there something that you want to say as we close?
I love Vern's last word. I would make a small amendment to the very wise counsel that you just gave, which is to say, make sure the very first person you tell the truth to is yourself.
Yeah.
Self-knowledge,
I told you,
end on that.
The wall was weak when I punched it, Marty.
Mal, do you have anything else to say? I've already done my closing remarks. Mal, anything else you want to ask?
Nah, honor and common sense, and it's been a delight talking with you guys. Thank you so much.
Same to you.
Well,
Vern, you're going to close this up?
You know, yeah, I'm going to close it up. You know, I should hear the outro music coming in here in a second, I suspect.